It is well decided, and we agree, that students do not shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse door. However, it is equally well decided that those constitutional rights will be administered in a way that is sensitive to the school environment.
Hello, 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 and welcome back to the High School SCOTUS podcast, where we talk about how the decisions of the Supreme Court, in the words of the Constitution, play out behind the schoolhouse gate. I'm Elise Spenner.
And I'm Hannah Saroff.
Today, it's time for a third episode, where we'll speak about the right not to speak. 2 weeks ago, we talked about students' free speech rights in the context of when schools can restrict the voluntary speech of students and when such regulations are unconstitutional.
This week, we'll look at free speech rights from a different vantage point. When can students choose to opt out of specific speech, lessons, or teaching? When can schools require that students take part in certain speech?
Before we get started, here's our word of the day.
Strict scrutiny.
Strict scrutiny.
Strict scrutiny.
Elise, what is strict scrutiny? Like, do you mean strictly scrutinizing something? Because I only thought you could normally scrutinize something.
In a way, yes. Strict scrutiny is the most burdensome standard of review for the government to meet. And just so you know, Hannah, normal scrutiny does not exist. Whenever a law infringes on a fundamental right, freedom of speech, for instance, or harms a suspect class that has historically been subject to discrimination, this could be discrimination based on race, religion, national origin, or alienage, strict scrutiny is applied.
Okay. So it's something that a court does when the government does something really bad.
Kind of, but not quite. Basically, these laws have to pass strict scrutiny in order to stay in place. They have to fulfill a compelling government interest and be as narrowly tailored as possible. That means they can't affect more people than they need to achieve that government interest.
So if a law infringes on someone's inherent rights or specifically targeted at a minority, the law has to be really important and really specific to be upheld by a court.
Yeah, I think you've got it. But let me offer two important caveats. One, the Supreme Court has not yet said that laws that infringe on Second Amendment liberties, despite being in the Bill of Rights, are subject to strict scrutiny. And laws that discriminate based on gender are not weighed under strict scrutiny. They are considered under a different standard. But that's for another day. For now, I think you have a handle on strict scrutiny.
Awesome. Thanks for that quick explainer, Elise.
Okay, back to it. Most prominently, the extension of the right not to speak came before the court in two cases concerning the Pledge of Allegiance. And that's what we're going to focus on today. The question of whether schools can force students to recite the pledge.
Both cases arrived at the court in the throes of World War II, and for good reason. In the mid to late 1930s, as war raged in Europe, more than 200 Jehovah's Witnesses were expelled from school in Pennsylvania and Massachusetts alone for refusing to salute the flag. Because most states had compulsory education laws, expelled students often had to find a private school and were straddled with the additional financial burdens of a non-public education.
The first case to consider whether these schools obeyed the Constitution in doing so was Minerville School District versus Gobitas. A tangent before we continue. The case was named Gobitas, G-O-B-I-T-I-S, but the students that challenged the school policy, Lillian and William Gobitas, spelled their last name G-O-B-I-T-A-S. That's why I slipped up a bit when referencing the case. I wasn't sure whether it was Gobitas or Gobitas, because it's all kind of muddled.
Gobitas children, both Jehovah's Witnesses, were expelled from their public school in Pennsylvania after refusing to participate in the Pledge of Allegiance. As Justice Frankfurter explained, the question was as follows. When does the constitutional guarantee compel exemption from doing what society thinks necessary for the promotion of some great common end?
The court wasn't much more sympathetic to the Gobitas' rights than to the spelling of their last name. The decision was 8-1, with Justice Stone in dissent. Justice Frankfurter's opinion found that states could force children to participate in the pledge. Why? Well, in the schoolhouse, the idea of national cohesion trumped one's personal beliefs. Frankfurter interpreted the question not as one of freedom of speech, really, but freedom of religion, and thus concluded that a general law that aims to promote a fundamental ideal, national unity, can make the same demands of students regardless of their religious objections. The opinion was clearly written on the precipice of war. Frankfurter hammered home his point with this statement: national unity is the basis of national security.
Furthermore, the parent is not singular in shaping a child's worldview, the opinion emphasized. Parents will always have the ability to offer opinions of their own in opposition to the views and loyalties of the state's educational system. Because this is true, school authorities retain the right to awaken in the child's mind considerations as to the significance of the flag. In our last episode, we talked about in loco parentis, teachers and administrators taking on the disciplinary role of parents at school. In some ways, Frankfurter's reasoning was similar in Gobitis. Schools and parents work symbiotically, although sometimes in opposition when molding a child's outlook and mind.
After the Gobitis ruling, 31 states made the pledge a compulsory part of the school day and expelled 2,000 children for refusing to swear allegiance to the flag. The animosity directed towards members of Jehovah's Witness was not limited to the schoolhouse. A mob burnt places of worship, destroyed the property of Jehovah's Witnesses, and boycotted their businesses. In Klamath Falls, Oregon, witnesses were attacked by members of the American Legion. Their cars were destroyed, their meeting was stormed, and people were harassed.
Newspaper editorials and magazine articles had openly strident criticisms for the court's decision in Gobitis. More than 170 newspapers openly declared their opposition to the ruling. Eminent law professors at prominent schools were similarly critical, and no wonder why. It basically codified this hatred of others.
Thus, the court faced severe public backlash for the decision in Gobitis and the hatred it engendered toward Jehovah's Witnesses. In an unusual move, several justices also admitted error in the decision in a separate case. When the court considered an entirely different case about the religious rights of Jehovah's Witnesses, Justices Black, Douglas, and Murphy included the following in their dissent: since we joined in the opinion of the Gobitis case, we think this is an appropriate occasion to state that we now believe that it was also wrongly decided. It was interesting to see such an overt choice by justices to say that they were wrong and admit that openly in another opinion.
3 years after Gobitis, the composition of the court had also changed. Justice Stone was now Chief Justice Stone, filling the place of the late Chief Justice Hughes. Justices Jackson and Rutledge joined the court as well. Both had already demonstrated a strong predilection to defend freedoms and liberties. So while it would normally be shocking for the court to reconsider a decision after just 3 years, the justices did that in the aftermath of Gobitis, granting certiorari in West Virginia Board of Education versus Barnett, which is a case that Professor Ross mentioned on our last episode.
At the start of 1942, amidst the upheaval following Gobitis, the West Virginia Board of Education passed a resolution that required daily flag salute for all public school teachers and students. If students refused to do so, they would be expelled, and their parents would be liable for prosecution on charges of delinquency. The students wouldn't be readmitted until they agreed to perform the salute, and could be punished with time in a juvenile reformatory.
Again, the challengers were members of Jehovah's Witnesses, which is really interesting when you think about how it directly contradicts Gobitis, and also on top of that, like, what groups are we seeing represented? This time, Walter Barnett brought suit on behalf of his children. Interestingly, when the case came before the Third Circuit, the panel of judges pretended the current court's hostility towards Gobitis and preemptively broke from the Gobitis precedent, which they're not like supposed to do. The judges were adamant that requiring Jehovah's Witnesses to participate in the flag salute would flagrantly violate their freedom of religion under the First Amendment.
In a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court backed the circuit court. Basically, they backed the court that said their precedent was wrong. Justice Jackson wrote that saluting the flag wasn't only a lesson in history, government, and civil liberty, but required students to declare belief. In that way, it's different than an AP US history test. A flag is a symbol of certain government ideas, and a flag salute tells the world that the student supports those ideas. Jackson's opinion included lapidary prose about the preservation of civil liberties. I better find my most sophisticated voice for this one. He wrote, "If there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, or force students to confess by word or act their faith therein."
Drop the mic. Sad one. Also, question. What if I don't agree with the symbols expressed in my U.S. history exam. I'm just putting it out there based on what you said. I know it's not government speech, but I'm just saying. But on a more serious note, for real, according to Justin Driver, in Barnett, Justice Jackson introduced three big changes in how courts examine free speech claims.
First, he reconceptualized the pledge requirement as raising a question not about freedom of religion, as Justice Frankfurter put it, but about freedom of speech. And he decided that there's a negative right to speech, as well as the commonly discussed positive one, which we mentioned in our previous episode. That's the one that the court upheld in Tinker.
Secondly, in contrast to Frankfurter's dissent, he put forward the idea that courts play an important role in monitoring public schools, so granting local authorities overly broad control over educational matters could really be a problem.
Right. Justice Frankfurter was a pretty traditional advocate of judicial restraint, and Justice Jackson really basically turned, did a 360 on that and changed the whole idea around of how we should view courts and schools. And to that end, Jackson recognized that a constitutional relationship exists and is always changing between the school and the citizen.
Similar to what you were saying before about Justice Frankfurter's policies, his dissent continued to champion judicial restraint, urging the court to leave such matters of educational policy to the legislature, who could best decide how to promote national unity. Justice Frankfurter had a really interesting start to his dissent. He said, "I'm a Jew, I'm a civil libertarian, I'm a judge, and it is only by the last of these three identities that guide my decision here." People are still kind of confused by that today, because shouldn't both his Jewish identity and his civil libertarian identity kind of play a major role in this case? That's what it's about at its core. So everyone's still a little puzzled by his decision on that one.
But generally, whatever they thought about Justice Frankfurter's dissent, the public had an overall positive response to Barnett. Justice Jackson said that he anticipated a good deal more criticism of Barnett than has taken place, and perhaps the American people have a stronger appreciation of what liberty is and of its value than we sometimes think.
What has the court done or not done in the 80 years since Barnett? Well, for one, the court has allowed the words "under God" to remain in the pledge, which is interesting considering God is a religious work. While their opining on this has largely been restricted to concurring opinions and dicta, justices have agreed that the phrase "one nation under God" is constitutional in the Pledge of Allegiance.
In 2004, in a time before the conservative supermajority likely squashed any chance of an objection to the religious intonations of the pledge, Michael Nudo challenged Elk Grove Unified School District's policy that allowed teachers to lead students in reciting the pledge. The court ruled on procedural grounds, kind of hedging their bets, and finding that Nudo didn't have the necessary custody over his daughter to bring a suit on her behalf.
But the impact of Barnett's ruling remains evident. On the 12-year anniversary of 9/11, a teacher attempted to force their fourth-grade student, a little fourth grader, a Jehovah's Witness, to recite the pledge, grabbing his hand and placing it over his heart. She claimed that her intention was to promote patriotism and instill the values of good citizenship. But by the next day, the teacher, not the student, was suspended and given an alternative job. How's that?
With today's podcast, we hope you learned a bit about how students were given the right not to speak in school and why that right is still rather narrow. While students are not required to salute the flag and recite the Pledge of Allegiance, that's really because of a rather narrow, specific circumstance when the school is requiring them to endorse a political opinion against their wishes and when that has the adverse effect of silencing their speech.
On the other hand, those districts still have really wide authority to decide what curriculum they teach in schools. Students, unfortunately, can't just refuse to participate in math class because they don't agree with how the district plans to teach algebra or calculus. As we said last episode, student speech rights, while existent, are still very much limited by this overarching desire to create an environment that is conducive to learning and developing. So those are the main objectives of school at the end of the day. 30 students who won't take a math test because they don't want to signal support for the curriculum seems a little dubious in the court's eyes.
If you're feeling bummed out at the end of this rather short episode because you just realized you still have to take your chemistry test tomorrow, we have some great content for you to check out on High School SCOTUS. First of all, I interviewed Sheldon Whitehouse recently, a senator and the fourth highest ranking member on the Judiciary Committee. Senator Whitehouse is also the chair of the Subcommittee on Federal Courts, Oversight, Agency Action, and Federal Rights. In this interview, we talked about his childhood in a family of Foreign Service officers, his ability to avoid the law school rat race, which Hannah and I already know we will definitely fall prey to, and his crusade to end corporate influence in politics and at the Supreme Court. It was really such a fun conversation, and if you have a chance, I would really recommend checking it out. As an added bonus, Senator Whitehouse also argued a case before the Supreme Court, Palazzolo versus Rhode Island. So he actually gave some really interesting insight into what it is like to argue before SCOTUS and what that environment feels like when you're there. In his words, it seems the bench curves around you. You're so close that your peripheral vision is just filled with the justices. I thought that was an amazing piece of imagery, and it just stayed with me.
Or you could check out my recent interview with Dahlia Lithwick, who needs absolutely no introduction. Since I'm still a little salty, I have to admit that Elise got to talk to Senator Whitehouse, who I love. And we talked about her journey as a lawyer and a journalist and why she started her podcast, Amicus, which is truly incredible. The start to that podcast may have technically involved some gentle Supreme Court trolling. I think you've got to read it to find some more out about that, because it made me laugh so hard during our discussion. And if you're curious about the shadow docket, you could also check out my old interview with Professor Steve Lapp, who I'm sure is frantically writing in addition to his book coming out soon, to address the Supreme Court's recent decision in Merrill v. Milligan, in which 5 justices stayed a district court decision requiring Alabama to redo their district maps to prevent dilution of Black voters. And as implied, that was on the shadow docket. And as always, for more coverage of the Supreme Court by teenagers, check out the High School SCOTUS website at highschoolscotus.com. On the blog, you can read oral argument previews, opinion analysis, and interviews with eminent legal scholars. Literally everything you need to stay in touch with the court. That's highschoolscotus.com.
We can't wait to see you next time. Thank you so much for joining Hannah and I on the 3rd episode of the High School SCOTUS podcast. We'll see you again in 2 weeks.